Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, not necessarily in this order, the Secretary of Labor on labor, David Remnick of the New Yorker magazine on Syrian refugees, and our weekly wrap-up of the week from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday, the 30th of August. Great to have you with us for the Marketplace podcast today. We're going to end the week by going back to the beginning, a survey, if you will, of the past 5 days in American business and the economy. Here for that, we've got John Carney from CNBC in our New York Bureau and Catherine Rampell. She is at the New York Times. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
So, John, I guess we'll start with you, and I want to talk for a second about the markets. You know, they've been squishy this week in theory because of Syria, but I want to test that premise. Is it because of Syria, or are traders just looking for a reason to be squishy?
Look, we've been squishy for several weeks. August was the worst month in markets since, I think, May of 2012. It was very bad. People like to blame it on Syria. It's not just Syria. We have a lot of obstacles coming up in the future. Probably the debt ceiling is, you know, the big fight coming up. And that is another reason for squishiness.
What I hear him saying, Catherine, is that we ain't seen nothing yet.
Well, certainly there are plenty of things to worry about going forward, domestically as well as internationally, you know, particularly since we have a debt ceiling fight coming up. And some concerns about an additional sequester. So certainly there are things to keep on the radar.
Hey, John, let me ask you about oil prices for a minute. That seems to be the one thing to me that might be genuine out of this. They were up a couple of percent per day earlier in the week. I actually didn't check them before I came into the studio. But that seems reasonable. That's skittishness.
Oh, sure. High oil prices are a drag on the economy. But one thing that was very interesting that happened today is after Kerry's very, you know, belligerent speech, the oil price did not spike up very much after that. And a lot of people think that's because, look, realistically, Syria directly doesn't have a big impact on oil prices. It doesn't export a lot of oil. It has some oil it produces domestically. Also, the U.S. is now producing a lot more energy domestically. So it may not have the same kind of spike effect that we've seen in, you know, past Middle East conflicts. We may actually be on secure grounds right now.
Catherine, let me pivot for a second to international markets and get away from the States for a bit. International markets have had a tough, you know, 2-3 weeks. India, Indonesia, Malaysia. A lot of the analysis has been that they're worried about the U.S. Federal Reserve ending its quantitative easing, beginning the taper, as much as I hate that word. Do you buy that?
I think it's reasonable to think that foreign markets are concerned about that. I mean, Fed policy has helped keep a lot of funding going to these developing nations, to these emerging markets. Yeah. And there's this threat that there's going to be a lot of money coming out of them going forward, which could hurt their currencies and has been encouraging them to raise interest rates to, you know, to have those higher yields to attract foreign funds.
John, you buying that? Or is it reasonable to think of a connection between the U.S. Federal Reserve and foreign markets?
I think it is. I think the quantitative easing, zero interest rate policy has driven a lot of money sort of abroad searching for yield. And the countries in the past have complained about this somewhat, saying we were sort of heating up their economies too much, causing too much hot money to rush into their economies. As the Federal Reserve tapers, as long-term interest rates go up, you'll see some of that money being drawn back. And that could result in slowing, particularly financial markets and all over the world, but in especially these Southeast Asian countries that we've seen it so far.
I was going to ask who you guys like for the next Fed chair, but I'm so sick and tired of that discussion. we're not even doing that. So, Catherine, I'm going to ask you one more thing, and we'll get you guys on your way on a Friday afternoon. Minimum wage is back in the news. These fast food strikes of the past day or two, getting a lot of press, getting some attention. Here's the question, though. Do you think big businesses actually notice when these discussions sort of try to get some traction?
I think they notice bad press, certainly. Yeah. And they've been getting some bad press in select cities, at select locations anyway. you know, the workers are asking for wage hikes of around $15
right.
an hour.
Right, minimum wage, yeah.
You know, wages that would meet $15 an hour. And Obama has been having trouble getting much traction for his proposal to to raise the minimum wage to $9 by 2015. So, you know, I think you're seeing some pockets of bad press, but it's not clear to me that there's been enough momentum built so far that the businesses are going to take notice, as you said, and actually raise wages anytime soon.
All right,
you never know.
Yeah, you never do know. That's the beauty of the news. Catherine Rempel at the New York Times and John Carney from CNBC. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Have a good
weekend. All right, have a good weekend. You too. On Wall Street today, well, we kind of talked about that one already. Down day, down week. Details, numbers, you know the drill. The Rim Fire up in the Sierra Nevada continues to burn. Best guesses are it's going to be another 10 days or so before it's fully under control. And I'll tell you, it's going to be an expensive 10 days. Direct costs so far come to $47 million. But there's a whole economic ecology up in the mountains that's going to be hit, too, even after the fire's out. There are cattle that graze in the high valleys up there, and the tourist dollars, of course. Even the Stanislaus National Forest itself, where most of the fire is burning, brings in money. A stand of trees that was part of a million-dollar timber sale is now gone. And all of that is before you even get to the science of the place. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
In the 1920s, some forward-thinking scientists drew very detailed maps of parts of the Stanislaus Tuolumne Forest.
They mapped every tree.
Not just every tree, but every stump, every rock outcropping, every fallen log, and all the brush. Carl Skinner is a scientist who worked on updating those maps.
One of the things that showed us is that we have about three times as many trees out there now as there was in the early 1920s.
Skinner and his colleagues are trying to transform this experimental forest into what it was like in the 20s, so they can study how U.S. firefighting policy has made fires bigger and more costly. By someday setting the forest on fire with controlled burns. If the Rim Fire burns the forest, it could destroy 80 years of research and investment.
It would give us a lot of information, but it would essentially end this experiment as it's being done.
A 75-mile drive south of the Stanislaus National Forest is the town of Groveland, which nearly burned. It's unseasonably quiet there, and the skies are hazy.
At the moment, they're incredibly smoky. And therefore, I've got a scratchy throat there, if you'll excuse it.
Peggy Mosley is the innkeeper of the Groveland Hotel. Normally, this holiday weekend, it would be totally full. Last night, only 2 of the 17 rooms were booked. But Mosley is hoping that will change soon. She wants to get people to come photograph the moonscape of charred forest.
One of the absolute incredible positives out of something like this is in the spring following a big fire. The wildflowers are absolutely unbelievable.
Mosley says she's already putting together some package deals. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
General Electric is probably best known for washers and dryers, I'd say. Maybe commercial aircraft engines, too, for those who truly follow the company. But retail lending has been a cash cow for GE for decades, which makes the reports today that the company is getting out of the consumer credit business all the more curious. Marketplace's Sarah McCammon has that story.
If you've signed up for one of those store credit cards, the ones that offer special deals, there's a good chance you've borrowed money from GE Capital. Daniel Holland is an analyst with Morningstar.
So if you go to Walmart or Home Depot and they ask you for a credit card, GE's actually backing that credit card.
But now Holland says GE wants to focus on its industrial products, jet engines, wind turbines, healthcare equipment. He says it's harder to be in the credit business in these days of financial reform.
You know, to the extent that GE can kind of just keep reducing the size of that business, it makes it less and less important for the Treasury to pay attention to.
And the federal government is paying attention. Industry analyst Brian Langenberg says GE's finance arm is so big, it's being regulated like a bank.
It just means more rules, and it has made the credit card business less attractive as part of GE.
Langenberg says since the financial crisis, credit is seen as a riskier business. And now, with the economy on the rebound, it's a good time to sell that part of the company. Plus, Langenberg says stockholders want what he calls a simpler story about GE.
Most investors either want to buy an industrial company or they want to buy a financial services company. They don't want to buy it in one piece.
They may soon have a chance to buy a piece of GE Capital. Analysts expect the company to begin offloading parts of its credit business in an initial public offering. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Focus in Washington this week has been foreign affairs, of course, Syria. Secretary of State John Kerry's been getting a lot of FaceTime with his boss, I'd bet, a lot of television time, too. But some members of the cabinet grind it out day after day without quite so much attention. Thomas Perez is one of them. He was confirmed as labor secretary about a month and a half ago. Mr. Secretary, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Kai.
I'm going to dig right in here, sir, and ask you this question. Unemployment in this country is 7.4%. What do you do all day with unemployment at 7.4%?
Well, we invest in skills. We invest in people. We invest in infrastructure. I speak to a lot of business leaders who are trying to hire. They want to hire. And the most frequent thing I hear from them is all too many people coming through the door don't have the skills necessary to do the job that I need to do. And that's a big part of what we do day in and day out at the Department of Labor is make sure that businesses have the workers they need with the skills that are necessary to grow business.
Let me try it a slightly different way. 162,000 new jobs last we heard from your department. Is that going to cut it? Is that good enough?
Well, again, I think the economy is slowly and steadily growing, but the president will be the first to say that we have to do more. We have to pick up the pace. There's so much more that can be done to grow the economy, including passing immigration reform, including investing in skills, including investing in infrastructure. And those are the things that the president continues to discuss, and I hope we'll get there.
I do want to point out that you've said invest probably half a dozen or more times in the brief period we've been on the phone. People here invest and they think government spending.
Well, you know, we talk a lot about the budget deficit. And I'll note that the budget deficit has been going down in the past 12 months significantly. But what we also have to do is talk about the skills deficit. That's what we need to do now. We need to make sure that the jobs of tomorrow, that people have the skills to do them.
This will sound more callous than I mean it to, but is it the government's job to make sure people have skills?
Well, I think the Department of Labor can play a critically important role as the quarterback of a demand-driven, very nimble workforce development system where we work with community colleges, with employers to understand what their needs are and to help train workers. If, you know, if you look at industrialized nations across the globe, we are near the bottom in terms of the public sector investment in skills. And as we're going to compete in the global economy, you need to understand that context.
Thomas Perez, he's the Secretary of Labor, been on the job about 6 weeks or so. Mr. Secretary, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up, on the ground in the Syrian refugee camps.
Refugees are in a very, very tight spot, but it doesn't mean they forget how to be human beings, even economic human beings, and you even have organized crime.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. On the last trading day of August, the Dow Industrial is down 30 points, 0.2%, closed at 14,810. The NASDAQ also down 30 points, 0.8% on that particular index, ended things at 35.89. The S&P 500 down 5 points, about a third percent, 16.32 at the bell. For the week, the Dow off 1.3%, the NASDAQ down 1.9%, the S&P 500 lost 1.8%. For the month, well, I won't give you the numbers, but man, it was down all the way around. All right, so to individual shares. Today, Krispy Kreme soured 15.1%. The sweet treat provider announced worse than expected second quarter sales. You know why that is? Because it's Krispy Kreme, for crying out loud. Computer company Hewlett-Packard clicked down 0.8%. Analysts said PC shipments will drop off more than predicted this year. In the pink today, Apache Corporation, the U.S. oil and gas company, pulled up nearly 9% after China Petrochemical, Asia's biggest refiner, bought a third stake in some of its Egyptian operations, interestingly enough. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Labor Day, a day to celebrate yourselves, you mighty workforce of more than 155 million. Markets are closed, and it's the last day to wear white shoes. A happy birthday shout-out to the Treasury Department. It turns 224. Who was the first Secretary of the Treasury? Alexander Hamilton. And September is National Courtesy Month. People, this is a courtesy blanket. Covers everything. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Thanks so much for your attention.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and a moment now for advertising and our continuing efforts to escape it, even though it does help pay for the content that we all crave. It's easy to get tired of banner ads online or commercials on TV, and there is no small amount of startup energy being put into helping people block those ads, and just about an equal amount of corporate energy fighting back, Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
So you click on a site, and all of a sudden, your speakers are blaring.
I need to be told that she is our...
And you're like, oh, what's that noise, and where's it coming from?
Rated PG-13.
Chad Russell is the chief technology officer at Blue Point Security. He says similar experiences led his company to go onto Kickstarter and propose a device to block ads. 2,000 people chipped in about $135, and AdTrap was born. It's a small white box that plugs into your router and...
It eliminates all the inbound advertising from any devices in your house.
So when you hop onto the web from your desktop, smartphone, or tablet, the sites you visit are stripped of ads, and the videos are commercial-free. Of course, websites and advertisers are fighting back.
It really is an arms race between us and the advertisers constantly.
Right now, the ad blockers have the upper hand. To change that, it's going to be costly for web publications, and it's unclear that a victor will emerge. Sean Blanchfield is with Pagefair, a startup in Ireland that helps web publishers sidestep ad blockers.
The most correct response to this is to address the underlying problem, which is the quality of the ads themselves.
AdTrap isn't the only ad blocker out there. The most popular one is called AdBlocker, and it's free.
You know, I would say ad blocking is on advertisers' radar, but it's not the top of their list.
Clark Fredrickson is with eMarketer. He says that's because there hasn't been a wide-scale adoption of the technology. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Netflix had revenues last quarter of $1 billion. That's revenues, not profits, but still quite a number. It got there in part because of what's come to be categorized as original content or original programming, House of Cards, for instance, and season whatever it was of Arrested Development. And on the theory that nothing succeeds like success, other Silicon Valley companies are getting into the production business, and they're making deals all over Los Angeles, as Alex Schmidt reports.
The storied studio lots of Hollywood, Warner Brothers, Paramount, Sony, are major landmarks around the city. But the creative landscape of Los Angeles is changing fast. Big tech has arrived. This is the interior of YouTube's new 41,000-square-foot production space. Liam Collins, head of the complex, is giving me a tour.
Where are we going next?
We are going to our biggest stage, which is 6,000 square feet, and we've done everything from build a boarding school in this stage to a comedy club.
The facility is one of many changing this town. There's the new Amazon Studios going up in a Tony office complex in Santa Monica. Microsoft also has production studios there. And dozens of other players are setting up shop to produce original content in the world's entertainment capital. Liam Collins again.
The reason our flagship is here is because LA is a center of gravity for creators all over the world, and there's no place more important when it comes to tapping creative resources.
big tech companies coming to LA would seem to be great news for tech boosters here. But the company's engineering teams, they're not here. LA just isn't the center of gravity for tech the way Silicon Valley is.
In the same way that Washington, D.C. is a political town, Los Angeles is a Hollywood town.
That's Sam Teller, managing director and co-founder of Launchpad LA, which supports local startups. Teller is in the business of turning LA into a tech hub. He says historically, the thing LA does best, original entertainment, just hasn't been that appealing to venture capital. But all in all, he sees Hollywood as a net positive.
The thing that really excites me about YouTube, Google, Amazon, Microsoft coming here is that that means their executives and their investors are going to be spending more time in LA. And in general, anything we can do to increase the connections between Silicon Valley and LA is a net positive for our community.
Another group benefiting from the presence of tech companies? Up-and-coming creators. Yeah, like writing partners Ryan Harrison and Dylan Riss are working on a comedic cop show, which they'll be pitching to one of the new content producers in LA, though they prefer not to say which. Here's Ryan Harrison.
The field of people buying content to me as a writer now looks very accessible, less limited than if my only outlets for trying to sell a show were cable or networks.
Still, Harrison says, the very best way to get noticed is to work with someone who's already made it, which is pretty old school Hollywood. Yeah, the landscape here is changing. But for now, LA continues to be a company town. I'm Alex Schmidt for Marketplace.
As John Carney was talking about up at the top of the broadcast, Secretary of State John Kerry made some fairly declarative remarks about Syria today. President Obama said some things of his own during a press availability, I guess, at the White House later on. The upshot is that we're all still kind of guessing what's going to happen and when it might. For Syrians, though, so much has already happened. There are refugees by the hundreds of thousands, many of whom have wound up in a single camp just over the border in Jordan. David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, is just back from some time in that camp. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. I want to begin by quoting you back to yourself out of this piece from the Zaatari camp. You say the people there, their dispossession is absolute. What does that look like?
Well, Zaatari is a refugee camp in northern Jordan, just across the border from Syria, and it's gone from obviously zero people about a year ago to 120,000. And these people are completely dispossessed in the sense that not only have they left their homes, some of them their families, almost everybody there has lost someone, friend, family who have died in the war. But there's very little prospect of them going back very soon because, as we all know, this horrendous and cruel war doesn't seem to have an end in front of it.
The amazing thing about this camp, and I suppose it happens in all camps, but the speed at which it happened in this one does seem to be remarkable. The way they have set up a functioning market economy.
It is amazing. Not only do you have the official camp of tents and caravans, but you also have an unofficial economy that sets itself up. These people come from southern Syria, where they're traders, shopkeepers, even smugglers. And very quickly, people set up all kinds of shops, a bridal shop, places where you can buy all kinds of food, all kinds of appliances. Refugees are in a very, very tight spot, but it doesn't mean they forget how to be human beings, even economic human beings. And you even have organized crime showing itself.
Well, explain that a little bit. You talk about the electricity mafia in this camp.
Well, the official camp sets up electricity grid to support the needs of the camp. But let's say you have a little business on the side and you have power needs as well. So someone will sell you access to illegally siphoned off power. It's really very interesting. It's like watching the growth and development of an instant city that's born of tragedy.
This is going to show my naivete about these things, but the bridal outfits, for example, or the flat screen televisions or appliances, where do they come from to be sold inside the camp? Are the Jordanians coming to the camp gate and doing deals?
Things are smuggled in.
Huh.
Economic life has a way of going on. even up through the sand and stone. And also life goes on. People are going to get married and people want to have a wedding, even in these straitened circumstances. People are born, kids need diapers. Where are you going to get all this from? And the official camp can't account for everything any more than the government can account for all of economic life in a small city in the United States or anywhere else. And you're in these tragic, straitened circumstances, and people find a way, and people make deals and create an economy out of nothing.
All of that said, though, David, is there hope or are they resigned?
Well, I think 6 months ago, there was a lot more hope in the camp. Right now, the situation is so awful. Chemical weapons being used, well over 100,000 people killed, cities decimated by artillery and all kinds of fighting, and a sense of resignation among the refugees, among other people, that this is going to go on for an indefinite period of time. And the mood in the camp is, on the one hand, more stable. There are fewer riots. But overall, there's a sense of deep emotional resignation, and that's very tragic to witness.
David Remnick is the editor of The New Yorker magazine. David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which the tooth fairy and inflation both figure prominently, so parents, please act accordingly. A new survey out by Visa shows the average kid in this country gets $3.70 a tooth, which just, I mean, come on, right? There are, thankfully, some regional variations. When the tooth fairy visits the Northeast, she goes a little bit crazy, $4.10 a whack. Kids in the Midwest get stiffed, relatively speaking, at $3.30 per tooth. If my kids happen to be listening, don't even think about it. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM on this Friday. Today, the Dow off 30 points, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ gave back 30 points, 0.8% there. The S&P 500 declined 5 points. That is a third of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the executive producer and vice president around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a good weekend, everybody. Let's do it again on Monday, all right? And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.